Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from fulminate to fingerprints. In this week's show, we're talking about criminal chemistry. We'll learn about medieval poisons, methamphetamine, and DNA testing. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. These days, everyone knows that arsenic is toxic, but for centuries, people were unaware of its dangers. It was a common ingredient in wall paint, artists' pigments, cosmetics, and even medicine. Experts speculate that long-term exposure to arsenic caused illness and death in many famous historical figures, including King George III, and possibly even Napoleon. Though their poisoning is presumed to have been accidental, that isn't the case for all arsenic victims. Throughout history, this element developed quite a reputation as a traceless murder weapon. The Borgia family is legendary for its mastery of death by arsenic. James Vocal has more in today's Element of the Week.
Arsenic's use as a poison can be traced back to the first century, when its deadliness was first understood. 700 years later, an Arab alchemist named Jabir first synthesized the most potent form of arsenic, arsenic trioxide, which is 500 times more powerful than the pure element. Arsenic in this form is a tasteless and odorless white powder that dissolves easily in liquids such as wine. A pea-sized amount is all that's required to kill a person. And the symptoms it produces, severe abdominal cramping, nausea, and diarrhea, match those of common ailments such as food poisoning and cholera closely enough to prevent any suspicion of foul play. A profound overdose of arsenic results in multi-system organ failure, which leads to death. Arsenic earned the nicknames Liquor of Succession and Inheritance Powder thanks to the notorious members of the House of Borgia. For this 15th century Italian family, power and wealth were just a pinch of arsenic away. Pope Alexander VI, born Rodrigo Borgia, was the family patriarch. He and his two favorite children, Cesare and Lucrezia, were accused of killing an untold number of colleagues and conspirators with cantrella, the arsenic-based poison they allegedly developed. It's believed that both Cesare and the Pope fell victim to the same poison they're accused of using. The Pope died a painful and untimely death. But luckily for Cesare, a single dose of arsenic doesn't always do the job. Though he became gravely ill, he didn't die from the stuff. Scandalous accusations against the Borgias endure, but they can't be proven. In any case, many others did use arsenic as a murder weapon. Its popularity waned by 1836, when English chemist James Marsh developed a test to detect arsenic poisoning, making the world a safer place. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm James Vocal.
James Vocal is curator of rare books at the Othmer Library of Chemical History at CHF. If only DNA tests had existed back in the Borgias' day, we might know for sure whether the family was guilty, right? TV shows like CSI have convinced the general public that DNA profiling is a crucial element of jury deliberation. But it's still a new and evolving science. The practice is fraught with inconsistencies, complications, and controversy. To find out more about the problems and promise of genetic identification in the courtroom, CHF's Audra Wolf spoke to Jay Aronson, author of Genetic Witness, Science, Law, and Controversy in the Making of DNA Profiling.
Welcome to the show, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in the introduction to your book, you describe how DNA profiling has sometimes been called the gold standard of truth-telling, and you quote former Attorney General John Ashcroft as calling it a truth machine, but you've argued elsewhere that there are problems with the technologies. Can you tell us what are some of the limitations of these techniques?
There are a whole range of things that can go wrong in DNA profiling, just like in any other scientific activity or in any other forensic test, going from basic things like mixing up the sample or contaminating a suspect sample with genetic material from the crime scene. I think more sort of insidious, you could have laboratory fraud or police fraud, and this is something that came up in the O.J. Simpson trial, where you have a laboratory investigator or a detective who really wants to convict this particular person, so they plant evidence or manipulate evidence to make it so that the DNA tests come out that the suspect DNA profile actually matches the crime scene DNA profile. So we shouldn't have complete trust in any technology, and DNA profiling is a technology like any other.
So at this point, you know, juries have really come to expect to see DNA evidence, and people sometimes refer to that as the CSI effect. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, and what are some of its implications for the courtrooms?
The idea is that gullible people who sit at home watching TV see these crime shows, and it actually changes their views about forensic evidence, and there are questions about which way it actually changes the evidence. Some people would say that watching these TV shows causes people who eventually end up on juries to wrongfully acquit a defendant based on the lack of the kind of forensic evidence that you see on TV. And some people have done studies that say that about 40% of the forensic evidence, forensic science that you see on TV just doesn't exist. Another group of people say that there's the CSI effect is that juries now wrongfully convict people based on an unrealistic belief in the infallibility of forensic evidence, including DNA evidence. There are some people who say that these shows actually alter the burden of proof, make it harder for prosecutors to actually get convictions because jurors have become accustomed to seeing DNA evidence in all rape trials that show up on TV or all murder trials. And in most cases, you just can't do that either for practical reasons or cost reasons. But I want to point out that there's really no strong empirical evidence for any of these things.
How are perceptions of DNA profiling technologies different among scientists versus among members of the general public who might be serving on juries?
I think that the general public probably sees DNA evidence as a kind of infallible technology, and that if you have DNA evidence that suggests that someone is guilty of a particular crime, then there's a very good, there's a very good chance that person is actually guilty. And I think that the general public might not be as aware of some of the problems with DNA profiling, the kinds of the potential for error or the potential for fraud.
Thanks so much for talking with us, Jay.
Thanks for having me. It was great to be on your show.
Jay Aronson is an assistant professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. Have comments or questions about something you heard on our show? Send your thoughts to distillations@chemheritage.org. DNA analysis is just one of the scientific tools used to catch criminals. Then there's the science of being a criminal. More specifically, the chemistry of cooking methamphetamine. In the AMC series Breaking Bad, a high school chemistry teacher discovers he has terminal lung cancer and decides to help his family by putting his knowledge to work, making speed. CHF's Jennifer Dionisio has this review.
The phrase Breaking Bad refers to veering off the straight and narrow, and that's exactly what happens in this AMC series. Viewers follow chemistry teacher Walter White as he careens away from his stable life in an RV/meth lab. At the start of the series, Jesse Pinkman, a former student and Walt's unlikely partner in crime, says, "This ain't chemistry, this is art." But Walt soon convinces him that there's an art in the science, though it's a dark art and not exactly a legal use for lab skills. In addition to the safety equipment Walt steals from the school where he works, the tools of his new trade include red phosphorus, blue iodine, and pseudoephedrine, an ingredient in most common cold medicines, which is hydrogenated to produce meth. After grinding, mixing, boiling, and extracting these main ingredients, Walt holds up a clear 3-inch crystal of incredibly pure methamphetamine, definitely an art. Moral hesitations aside, it turns out that criminal chemistry is actually pretty cool. When Walt and Jesse are held hostage by rival drug dealers in the first episode, Walt saves the day with his understanding of the potentially hazardous reactions between meth's mainly over-the-counter ingredients. Under the guise of revealing his cooking process, he combines chemicals to make toxic phosphine gas, killing one attacker and knocking out the other. He later advises Jesse on the best way to dispose of the body using hydrochloric acid. Here's a hint. Dissolve the body in a polyethylene bucket, not a bathtub. In another episode, he explodes fulminated mercury by throwing it on the floor, shocking a hot-headed meth dealer who'd been giving him a hard time. Seems that PhD in chemistry is pretty useful in ways that would shock Walt's students, and perhaps interest them more in the subject. Scientists can find special amusement from the series. the show's creator, Vince Gilligan, a former writer and producer for The X-Files, has described himself as a science groupie and takes pleasure in subverting traditional ideas of what chemistry can be. As a result, Breaking Bad represents chemistry accurately, within legal limits. Of course, it can't show the entire process of cooking meth, lest the series serve as an instructional guide for an aspiring underground chemist. But the scenes showcasing Gilligan's love for science soften the grim circumstances his characters find themselves in and elevate Walt from a pitiful man almost too painful to watch into a swaggering anti-hero with his superpowers and arsenal of molecules. For Distillations, I'm Jennifer Dionisio.
Jennifer Dionisio is Program Coordinator for Biotechnology at CHF's Center for Contemporary History and Policy. Breaking Bad has just been renewed for a second season on AMC. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from the anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman. Crime is naught but misdirected energy. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer, with help this week from Lissa Rome. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indivero, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.